Hello, I'm Jim Falzerano. It's Wednesday, the 24th of June. In today's program, Barack Obama makes his debut in the Rose Garden and takes a hard line against Iran.
The United States and the international community have been appalled and outraged by the threats, the beatings, and imprisonments of the last few days. I strongly condemn these unjust actions, and I join with the American people in mourning each and every innocent life that is lost.
Children as young as four are being excluded from school.
The schools inspectorate went into about 60 schools to find out why they had high rates of exclusions. And what they were really shocked and surprised by and weren't expecting was a very high rate of children acting in sexually inappropriate ways.
And the recession hits the palace. Even Prince Charles is cutting back.
So the tantalising question was for many of us who have been following the MP's expenses story was, you know, has he bought himself a duck island?
But first, Bill Overton's got the headlines.
US President Barack Obama's condemned the violence in Iran against protesters. In a speech in Washington, he said he was appalled and outraged by the threats, beatings and imprisonments. And he rejected the Iranian government's accusations against foreigners as an obvious attempt to distract people from what's taking place within Iran. Britain's expelling two Iranian diplomats because two British officials from our embassy in Tehran have been told to leave. Gordon Brown admits it is a tit-for-tat action, but says he has no choice after the unjustified expulsion of our diplomats. The school's inspection agency, Ofsted's, called on primary schools to stop suspending young children. It found that pupils as young as 4 years old have been excluded from school for biting, swearing, kicking, or hitting others. Some schools had seen similar behaviour without suspending their youngsters. Ofsted said that exclusion was avoided when children were well managed and supported. The Children's Society says a government pilot scheme to help failed asylum seekers and their children return home has only managed to help one family leave Britain. The scheme in Kent cost £1 million but dealt with only 13 families. The United Nations is discussing the world's financial crisis at its headquarters in New York today. It's the first time that rich and poor nations will discuss the problems together. The summit's intended to give a chance to poorer nations to have a say on a crisis that has hit them the hardest. 25-year-old Elena Baltacha became only the second British player to get through to the second round of Wimbledon yesterday evening. In three sets, she beat Ukrainian Alona Bondarenko, who's ranked well above her at 33 in the world. Andy Murray also got through against American Robert Kendrick. No other British players survived the first round, and Murray's complained the lack of depth in British tennis is disappointing and not acceptable. He gets his win on to both front and sports pages of the morning papers. Few Murray goes through, writes The Express. One down, six to go, is the Guardian headline. The Independent calls him the last man standing, as does The Times, which goes on, glum Murray left to survey the wreckage. And The Sun says he blasts the Brit flops under the headline, shame on you. The Mail takes a different line with a picture of Baltacha on its front page with the caption, Wimbledon shock, a British girl actually wins. Otherwise, The Times and The Guardian pick up Barack Obama's speech about Iran. The Guardian says he condemned Iran's unjust crackdown, and The Times that he strikes out against Tehran's iron fist. The Independent chooses the tit-for-tat embassy expulsion, saying the diplomatic battle heats up. Finally, The Telegraph warns us that pensions crisis to hit millions of workers. The Mail says it's pensions, the awful truth, reporting that 96% of final salary schemes are doomed. State pensions are withering on the vine and that our OAPs are the worst off in Europe. There's more news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
Barack Obama held his first news conference in the White House Rose Garden, which has been the setting for so much presidential history. He told reporters that he condemned the, quote, threats, beatings, and imprisonments of the last few days in Iran. Our Washington correspondent, Ewan McCaskill, reports.
He went much further than I expected in support of the protesters. He used condemnation for the first time. He'd been careful up until that point to keep his language moderate. But he was quite emotional and passionate.
The United States and the international community have been appalled and outraged by the threats, the beatings, and imprisonments of the last few days.
So it was a completely different tone from what we've heard from Obama over the previous week. all his comments up to that point had been really measured, intent on not giving any material to the Tehran government that they could use against them. But he seemed to abandon that at the press conference, going and just condemning the Tehran government outright.
Some in the Iranian government, in particular, are trying to avoid that debate by accusing the United States and others in the West of instigating protests over the election. These accusations are patently false.
What struck me about it was that he said that this was old politics. He described it as a tired strategy for the Iranian government to put the blame in the West. This was basically an internal problem for the Iranian people, a debate within Iran. And he basically said this is a knee-jerk reaction for the Iranian government to try and shift the blame to America or Britain. One of the peculiarities of this press conference was, I think it was maybe second or third question, he went to a reporter from the Huffington Post, and he went specifically to that reporter because the Huffington Post has been taking questions from Iranians, protesters. Obama seemed to be aware of this and asked the Huffington reporter to convey what the Iranian protesters have been asking about. And the Huffington Post reporter asked him a specific question that he'd received from a Iranian. Now, the danger of that for Obama is that that opens him up to accusations from the Iranian government of directly interfering. There is Obama talking directly to the Iranian protesters. But Obama didn't seem to care about that.
All across the internet, we've been seeing a lot of reports coming directly out of Iran. I know that
Obama, I think, has been seen differently in the US from, say, Europe. Most commentators in America, well, certainly in Washington anyway, thinks he's done really well, that it was right to be cautious early on. So he's had this balance, and he repeated it again at the press conference.
I think it is not too late for the Iranian government to recognize that there is a peaceful path that will lead to stability and legitimacy and prosperity for the Iranian people. We hope they take it.
He said the number one objective is to try and engage Iran in direct negotiations on its alleged nuclear weapons ambitions. That's the number one priority. So he wants to keep that alive and at the same time manage some sort of criticism of the Iranian government for its crackdown. So I think he achieved that yesterday. He kept alive the offer, but at the same time said, look, the US is not a threat to the Iranian regime. We're not interested in regime change. The offer is still on the table.
That was Ewan McCaskill. An Ofsted study shows that schools have excluded students as young as 4. I asked Polly Curtis, our education editor, how big the problem is.
This survey looked at primary schools, so it's a new problem that people are really concerned about. And the figures show that in 2007, it's about 40,000 children were excluded from primary schools. And that included 4,000 pupils who were under the age of 5. And that's what's really got people concerned, is this idea of rising number of their fixed-term exclusions, so it's temporary exclusions, amongst very young children.
So what kinds of behaviours led to students being excluded at such a young age?
Well, this report was triggered by those figures, and Ofsted, the schools inspectorate, went into about 60 schools to find out why they had high rates of exclusions. And what they were really shocked and surprised by and weren't expecting was a very high rate of children acting in sexually inappropriate ways. So children touching other children, displaying knowledge they shouldn't really know about at the age of 5. And it's another kind of sign that, these tend to be schools in very difficult areas, disadvantaged areas, children living below the poverty line. It's another sign of a particular sad thing that's happening with our children, I think.
What other kind of behaviours were cited in terms of what caused these students to be kept out?
It ranged from swearing, biting, attacking teachers, attacking other children, throwing chairs, just routinely ignoring the rules. But the report looked at schools which managed to keep exclusions very low and others which had very high rates of exclusions. And it did find that there's a hell of a lot a school can do to not exclude children. It can provide lots of different ways of support and mentoring and children supporting each other. And there's a lot it can do to force kids out by having very rigid behaviour policies, which, you know, five-year-old kids might not understand. And it found situations where schools which had a very high turnover of staff tended to have a lot of exclusions. That seemed to be a sign that something going wrong in the school, not necessarily the children. Teachers sometimes were putting pressure on the head teacher to exclude pupils, or the unions were saying, you've got to get rid of this child, we can't deal with this child. Most head teachers, most schools kind of desperately don't want to be excluding children, but some were more ready to than others.
Is this a postcode lottery problem? We'll be able to look at the demographics of an area and say this school is more likely to exclude students?
There's a lot of very strong evidence that links deprivation, social and economic deprivation, to higher levels of behaviour. That's, you know, that's no surprise. If you're a child with four siblings living in a one-bedroom flat, you're going to have a more difficult life than your classmate who lives in a big leafy village somewhere. That is definitely a factor, yeah.
One more question. Should we conclude that young children are just becoming more badly behaved, or is that too simplistic?
I think that probably is too simplistic. I think there's lots of different factors. When you look at the sexual behaviour problems they record, one expert I was talking to was saying, well, you know, this is the rise of the internet. They do have access to things. TV is more sexually explicit at an earlier age. There are other things going on. It's not that children are bad. It's that they're dealing with a lot of things. And when you have a very kind of socially unequal society, as we do, children at the bottom of that heap do suffer more.
Polly Curtis. For more on this story, go to guardian.co.uk/education. Also on the website today, how Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie have kept an international magazine afloat. Go to guardian.co.uk/media. Richard Norton Taylor argues that Britain's military objectives in Afghanistan are not clear enough. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/comment. Read a first-person account from an Iranian woman who took part in the demonstrations in Tehran. That one's at guardianweekly.co.uk/politics. And you can follow minute-by-minute coverage of the Wimbledon Tennis Championships at guardian.co.uk/tennis. The new Speaker of the Commons, John Bercow, has donned the traditional regalia in the service of parliamentary reform. Simon Hoggart sketches his first day on the job.
I trooped along at 2:30 to the lobbies to watch the Speaker's procession, a tradition as old as time itself. Wanted to see what had changed. Well, not a great deal. There was still a retinue or posse of five people, making six altogether with the new speaker, people with maces, that's a sergeant at arms, a train bearer, though without a train to bear. That seemed rather otiose, you might say. The speaker's chaplain, again slightly odd since Mr. Bercow is of the Jewish faith. Still no doubt they'll find alternative work for these people. Anyway, they made their way to the chamber. There it was time for health questions, and the first held with the new Secretary of State, Andy Burnham, who seemed perfectly competent insofar as any health secretary is. Not a lot to do, frankly. In the chamber, the Speaker doesn't do a great deal except shout out names, and provided he's reasonably fair and distributes the questions and the speeches, you know, roughly according to party, and doesn't make too many boo-boos and seems to get the name right. And to be fair, Bercow spent a lot of time in the chamber himself, so he knows who everyone is. He's got a considerable feel for the place. And within moments of him arriving, we're deep in a discussion of testicular cancer. Well, not perhaps the most fun subject to bring up. He also made it very clear from the moment he started was he wanted crisp, quick questions and crisp, quick answers. And we noticed that under the last speaker, sometimes questions just went straggling on and on and on, and you'd get to the end of a three-quarter an hour session and discover that you'd hardly dented the order paper. He wanted this to go much faster. He stopped MPs very firmly from paying tribute to him, so I don't need that. Just carry on, ask your question and so forth. He didn't do badly at all. And by the way, he was dressed in a very simplistic fashion. Instead of ancient ruffles and things like that, he dressed simply as a chap in a dark suit with a blue tie. One slightly rough moment in the statement Gordon Brown made about the European Council meeting, which ended last week in Brussels. At one point, he was accusing the Tories of shacking up with a bunch of weirdos, right-wing nutcases in the European Parliament. This is something that Gordon Brown's been banging on about for a long time. The Tories decided to shut him up by baying and shouting. Speaker leaned over, the new Speaker, and said, the Prime Minister must be heard.
Mr. Speaker.
Prime Minister must be heard. Preferably in courteous silence. Prime Minister.
No, I know why they don't want me.
Calm was restored and things went on very much as normal. So he may be the clean break speaker, but I don't think we'll see that in the chamber. The clean break will have to come behind the scenes when he really starts the effort of restoring Parliament's good name.
That was Simon Hoggart.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Even Clarence House is feeling the credit crunch, as Charles and Camilla are reduced to wearing the same outfits more than once. I asked Robert Booth about the new royal austerity.
He says he's responding to the recession and the financial difficulties that everyone in the country are feeling. And so what he's been doing is looking quite carefully at some of his expenditures. In particular, his aides pointed out that he hasn't been on a foreign holiday in the last year. He often takes a skiing holiday to Switzerland. And also that he's unlikely to be doing that in the coming year. Also, the accounts that we've been looking at cover the Duchess of Cornwall's expenditure as well. And it's notable that in the last year, she didn't go on either a trip to the Greek islands, which she often does on her yacht, or to the Caribbean, as she's done before. And instead, the couple have been going to stay at Birkhall, the Scottish home that was previously owned by the Prince's grandmother, the Queen Mother. So they've been trying to save on holidays. It also seems that they've been trying to save on their utility bills, like many people, and they've even installed meters which show up who's using too much energy in the offices of their premises. And it seems that they've been paring down on the personal staff somewhat as well, with the spending on valets, butlers and cooks being reduced, although apparently none have actually been laid off. Some of some vacancies haven't been filled, and in other cases their work has been transferred to official business.
Now, the other interesting point about this is that evidently Prince Charles has managed to save on tax despite the fact that his overall income has increased. Can you shed any light on that?
The reason his overall income has gone up is really to do with the fact that the government has given him more money to do more things for it. So, for example, he was sent on two long-haul tours this last year, one to Latin America and one to the Far East. Normally, he would only do one. So he's been able to offset all of the costs of both of those tours against tax. And he's also been able to offset the regular costs of his conventional work in the UK. What is slightly unclear is exactly what he's offset against tax. He has talked about offsetting, for example, about £60,000 on the costs of his gardens, but what we don't know is exactly what he's been spending on his gardens. So the tantalising question was, for many of us who have been following the MP's expenses story, was, has he bought himself a duck island?
Now, you mentioned MP's expenses. It seems pretty clear that Clarence House is sensitive to this issue of spending. Do you have any sense of how the public might respond to these details, or in fact are responding?
Well, he's been publishing his annual review now, I think, for 6 years, and it's, been in the interests of transparency. And I think normally people are fairly surprised at the amount of cash that he spends on things like his gardens. They clearly rush to defend that spending, saying, thousands of visitors come to these gardens each year. And it becomes a bit of a ritual, really, of people looking slightly askance at the amount that he lays out on parties and his homes and particularly his travel, which is incredibly expensive, largely to do with security concerns, but also because he has got he seems to have a great fondness for travelling in quite luxurious style.
Austerity for the royals as well?
A little bit, not too much though.
That was Robert Booth. Today marks the debut of The Guardian's bike blog and bike podcast, the first UK-based program to cater to everyday cyclists. In the inaugural podcast, Sean Ingle interviews triple Olympic champion Sir Chris Hoy.
It'll be really nice to think that we've inspired people to get on their bikes, and I believe that there was a sudden increase in the membership in the British Cycling Federation after Beijing. So, you know, to see these things as a result of your success in the track is really very satisfying indeed. I think it's now about capitalising on that interest. It's about striking when the iron's hot and making sure that we do try and, you know, get everybody involved and get them on their bikes. And most people have bikes. I believe there's like over 2/3 of the population have at least one bike in their household. So it's about getting people to get them out of the garage, get them out of their shed, oil the chain, dust the bikes down, and make the most of them, whether it's just cycling for fun, whether it's cycling for health, for fitness, or for all these reasons, you know, commuting to work, commuting to school, or if they're even interested in taking up cycling as a sport.
Do you cycle for fun when you're not racing? And if so, what bike do you use?
Yeah, I do. I think it's important to ride my bike for fun as well as just for training, because otherwise I would just associate it with pain. You know, every time you sling your leg over a bike, it's going to hurt. So if you still ride your bike for fun, then you remind yourself why you took it up in the first place. And, you know, I do road rides through the countryside where it's nice and quiet and you get away from it all. And it reminds me what it's all about. And I certainly plan to go back to doing more mountain biking when I get a bit, or when I finish my cycling career, because I just love that. There's nothing better than getting up in the hills away from everything and the peace and quiet, and you can just enjoy, you know, being active in some really beautiful scenery.
Are there any particular routes that you're particularly fond of?
For mountain biking, I suppose the ones that mean the most to me are the Pentland Hills in Edinburgh, which is just south of Edinburgh. And I used to go there when I was in my early teens. And it's incredible that you're that close to a major city and yet you can feel so far away from it all. But really, all over Scotland, there's lovely places to go. There's great parts in the Lake District and Wales. You know, there's just numerous places you can get off-road and away from the traffic and really make the most of mountain biking.
That was Sean Ingle talking to Chris Hoy. This podcast was produced by Phil Maynard. I'm Jim Falzerano. Thanks for listening.